Hello, you're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Of course, that's Maxine Nightingale. And of course, it's a song from one of my favorite movies of all time, Slapshot. That's part of the theme. Please welcome our guest, Brian Petrovic. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Steve. Who are you?
Brian has played key roles with the Portland Pirates. He's known also as one of the best goalies in college hockey, which we'll talk about. Lives here. And what do you think about the movie Slapshot? Do you remember it? It's got to be.
Classic. Well, a little background to that. When I started my professional career with the New Jersey Devils, my first assignment was to run the Utica Devils, which was the minor league affiliate at that time of New Jersey.
Wow.
And Slapshot was actually shot in the arena our team played in.
Wow.
So there's a history there. There's a tie there.
I want to talk about movies and the Hanson brothers, but let's start with, thank you for coming here today.
Pleasure.
Hockey is certainly in the news where the Bruins are starting their playoff run. I think the Pirates season is over, but we'll talk about Pirates for next year coming back to the Civic Center. But let's talk for a few minutes about your background, how you ended up here in Maine, and as I mentioned before, playing at Harvard, going to school at Harvard. So let's talk about the early years of Brian Petrovic, and then we'll talk about what's going on here in Maine.
Well, the early years had that connection to hockey, and I don't think it's ever left. I was fortunate when my playing days ended at Harvard to stay in the business and had chance to jump into college athletics soon after completing my stint at Harvard, and spent 4 years at the Eastern College Athletic Conference, got my feet on the ground, got some great experience, dealt with hockey primarily, but with a lot of other sports as well. And then I kept my involvement with the game in a business opportunity, and I was running and operating a summer hockey school in the Berkshires for 6 or 7 years.
What part of the Berkshires?
In East Hampton, Massachusetts, the Wilson Northampton School.
Mm-hmm. For literally 1 year, I played hockey at the Berkshire School, which is out in Sheffield, which is out by Great Barrington.
And I think when we first met, we talked about that. And I played at Hotchkiss for 4 years.
Well,
so
yeah,
big rival of Berkshire.
Hotchkiss, Choate, and Berkshire. Apparently, and again, I learned this after the fact in the spring of my year at Berkshire, you were supposed to go to classes.
Indeed.
Indeed. And so at the end of my year playing some hockey at Berkshire, one of the teachers came to me and said, you know, we understand you're playing a lot of hockey, but we really expect you to. And so it was a mutual decision for me to go back into the public school system, but it's a beautiful area.
It's a beautiful area. And I'm sure you've got some fond memories from your 1 year experience there. But
many, many fond memories.
No, it was great. And then I had an opportunity, as I was still involved in the game, to get into the advertising business for a while. I spent 4 years in Boston for two agencies, had a great experience there, really loved that part of the business, as you now have been very successful and involved in. And then I had the opportunity to get back into hockey on a professional level. Lou Lamorello, who was an individual I knew when I was at the ECAC, just took over the New Jersey Devils, and this was in the spring of 1987. He reached out to me. I was the first person he hired and came on board with Lou, and the rest is history with what Lou Lamorello has done with the New Jersey Devils. So that first assignment, going back to the Slapshot reference, was running the Utica Devils, which I did for a couple of years, then spent 5 or 6 years in New Jersey as vice president of marketing, and then made my way west to USA Hockey, where I spent almost 8 years as a deputy executive director and executive director of the USA Hockey Foundation.
So for people that may not be familiar in terms of whether it's the Olympics or amateur hockey, explain a little bit about what USA Hockey is and how that becomes such an important system for players, not necessarily going into professional hockey in the NHL, but in terms of all the other areas of hockey, both for men's and women's hockey now.
Well, as the national governing body for the sport, it's the place where you start. For those who are getting into the game at the ages of 3, 4, 5, and 6, it's the learn-to-play opportunity, and it then moves into whatever pattern and whatever route the individual wants to go, whether it's a competitive route or a recreational one or as a volunteer or as a referee or a coach. So national governing bodies provide that opportunity for those who are interested in getting engaged in the sport to do whatever it is they want to do. And that goes from cradle to grave. It goes from the introductory level up to the Olympic Games and the World Cup, which I had an opportunity to work with.
And obviously being involved with hockey as much as you are, I'm sure you watch the Olympics. disappointing on both sides, right? Both for men's and women's.
Yeah, very much so. And as you know, I had an opportunity in 1998 when the NHL, for the first time, shut down to put their best players on the ice to be the team leader of our men's team in Nagano, Japan. And we went into that tournament as heavy favorites, essentially the same roster that we had in 1996 when we won the World Cup of Hockey was with us in 98. And it was a disappointment, and much the same way as this past Olympics has been for the U.S. men's team. So yeah, got to pick up and fix it.
Let's talk about women's hockey for a second. All of your experience has been primarily in men's hockey. But a couple of years ago, a family friend of mine, Reagan Carey, became the executive director of women's hockey, USA Hockey. And I had never been to a women's hockey game. And I went to the World Championships in Burlington, Vermont. And I've played a little bit of hockey, certainly not at your level, but I've played enough that I really respect the sport. Like the other 2 million people who grew up in Boston, I attended the game where Bobby Orr scored the winning goal. And I say that facetiously because everyone I've ever met says they were at that game. And it had to be 2 million people sitting there. So I'm familiar with the sport, and I had never seen women's hockey in person. And I went to the championships, and I saw Women's USA play Canada. And I went to the shoot-around in the morning. It was amazing how far women's hockey has come and the sport itself. And unbelievable athletes, great technical skill. Because it doesn't have the physical elements of men's hockey, I think it's a more technical game where it's more precise. But those girls really play hard, and it was really enjoyable. Yeah. And have you had a chance to go to many women's hockey
games? Oh, absolutely. I mean, the years that I was at USA Hockey, the program was just beginning to arrive at the world stage. And what the U.S. and Canadian programs have done has been incredible. To your point, amazing skill, amazing dedication, amazing athleticism.
Right.
And for a sport that doesn't allow hitting, it's a very physical game. And you can see how it has kind of moved to a more physical situation. However, it still get the beauty and the skill and the speed that you would want to have with a women's sport.
It's incredibly physical because they don't have the same checking, but they're hustling for the pucks, and there's body contact, and
the strength of these women right now is incredible. I mean, they are world-class athletes,
right?
There's no question about it.
It was actually a fight this spring. I think USA and Canada, they dropped the gloves, and it was like, that's a little unusual.
Well, and I think it was more than that when our former coach, Kevin Dineen, took over the program in Canada. His first game was against the U.S., and in that particular game, I think there were a series of fights. So it set the tone for what was going to be an incredible matchup at the Olympics.
But in the Olympics, the women in USA and Canada, I believe, are far and beyond the other teams. And so there's been a little bit, there was a little bit of pushback suggesting, should women's hockey be a sport if you only have two dominant powers?
It's an issue. There's no question. And I think as the eight dominant countries in the world who play the sport on the men's and the women's side planned for a gap that wasn't as large as it is right now. So I think at the Olympic stage, there's some concern that only two teams right now, maybe three or four, are competitive.
Right.
Is it the type of activity that should deserve an Olympic platform moving forward? So there's going to be a discussion.
There's a little bit of a chicken and the egg, right? That if you take it away, then the development of the sport will probably be slow. But if you give people a chance to say, develop your Olympic program now,
right,
then hopefully on the world stage. But the women lost a really close one.
That was incredible.
In the last couple of minutes of the game.
Yeah.
And then the men, one of the early games I watched was incredible. The shootout, it went to two overtimes?
It was amazing.
And what was the name of the guy that took all the...
TJ Oshie from St. Louis. It was amazing.
He took like all of it. That was like the high point for me for men's hockey in the Olympics. Yeah. And then they lost.
Just self-destructed, which is unfortunate. So it's just in a short series like that, it can turn on a dime. And unfortunately, it was a talented team. And it will be again. It was a young team. Our country has gotten to the point where it now competes for a gold medal at every Olympics, which was different than it was 20, 25 years ago. So disappointment, but they'll be back. The U.S. team is not going to go anywhere.
I mean, all the way from, do you believe Al Michaels in Lake Placid, do you believe in miracles to, that was one of the high points, obviously, and you must remember that.
Oh, very well.
As a kid.
In fact, I was there. So
you were really there.
I'm not going to make that up.
You were there at Lake Placid for Do You Believe in Miracles?
And
that was the bronze medal game, right? Or that was the semis.
Exactly.
And most people think that was the gold medal
but
game because there was so much focus. They still
had
to go play Finn for the gold medal.
That's right.
By the way, we have Brian Petrovic here. He has held leadership positions in Portland Pirates for many, many years, working with the team and involved with hockey for many, many years, a proud native of Yarmouth. So talk a little bit about how you ended up moving to Maine and how you first became involved working with the Portland Pirates.
Well, when I was still in Colorado, a bunch of former teammates, folks that I've had relationships with and had done some business with over the years, started to have a conversation about, wouldn't it be interesting to get into ownership at the professional level, at a minor league level, at the American Hockey League? And knowing I had some experience with the New Jersey Devils and with the Utica Devils in the American League, it was easy for me to become a part of that conversation. So we started looking at markets in the Northeast that could potentially be a home for an American League franchise. And originally, our idea was to find a market where we could have ownership of both a hockey team and a baseball team. So we could have one essentially holding company, one operating company, own and operate two sports in two different seasons. So we could eliminate redundancy and create some efficiencies. And we spent about 8 or 9 months seriously looking at Manchester, New Hampshire, which at the time was just building the Verizon Center, did not have a minor league baseball team, but there was discussion at the municipal level to ultimately build a minor league baseball stadium downtown. Long story short, the opportunity just became a little bit too pricey for us, and we knew at the same time that the franchise in Portland was available for sale. Dave Fisher at the time was the majority owner, so we kind of pivoted from the baseball hockey model, knowing that the Burke family was not going to be in a position to sell the Sea Dogs, and rightfully so for all good reasons. We latched onto the opportunity in Portland, and we saw some upside. We saw the need 15 years ago for a building, either a renovated building or a new civic center, and knew that it was going to be a major missing piece to financial success. But we stepped in and took a commitment to that opportunity in late 1999 and closed in the business in 2000. And 14 years later, the community finally has a renovated facility, which was one of the major pieces that the franchise has been missing. And the rest is history. So hopefully a turning point for American Hockey League success in Portland.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. I don't want to go into, there was obviously some conflict between the Civic Center, the team, in terms of terms. And thankfully, as a season ticket holder myself, I'm glad it was worked out. And so the team played in Lewiston-Auburn area this past season, and that season's ended. What does it look like for the team next year going to the Civic Center? I was fortunate to go on kind of an insider tour a few weeks ago of the newly renovated Civic Center. And not only, in my opinion, are the concourse areas much better and the kind of the experience, but what most fans won't see are the locker room areas and kind of the infrastructure down below, where for concerts and for sports. And then I saw the Pirates locker room, which looks palatial. It almost looks like an NHL locker room. It was still being built, but it looks great. What will that transition next year mean for the team, do you think, moving into the facility?
It'll provide a new beginning. Again, it's an opportunity to start fresh. We were fortunate this year, because of some lease issues, to be able to play in Lewiston and not have to disperse our players all over the country. So at least we had the opportunity to stay in the market. For many of our fans, the trip to Lewiston was a little bit of a challenge, but for many it wasn't. So we had a chance to keep the brand alive. But I think what people will see next year when they come into the Civic Center is an incredibly attractive facility, one that they're going to be proud of and one that's going to make a difference, you know, not only to what the team will be able to live with, but for the fan experience, it's going to be a dramatic change. And we're really excited about how I think our fans are going to react to it. And I think it's going to be very positive.
Now there are club seats and there's a
it's
lot
just a
of
different
amenities.
Feel. Yeah, it's just, I mean, the additional square footage when you walk into the building,
right,
and it's just not a cramped,
right,
dirty, dark environment. It's just going to create what we think is going to be an exciting new impression for fans, not just for hockey, but for all events in the
sure.
Civic Center.
And I'm sure I'll get the number wrong, but when I was going on a tour a few weeks ago, there was one restroom, a woman's restroom, on the lower floor, and the person who was giving the tour said, this one restroom has more facilities for women in this one room than the entire building had before.
I wouldn't be surprised.
So things like men's room, women's room, the concession area. It looks completely different.
Totally. I mean, a 300% increase of points of sale for food and beverage, again, goes back to the need to change the patron experience. And as you know, in the event business, the food and beverage piece is very important. So, and it's amazing what new flooring, a coat of paint, some lighting, some new wayfinding signage will do for improving the experience. And I think that's going to be, it's going to be a dramatic change for the community.
My big change is from many, many years ago, from knowing you and the team, I was able to get some Pirates tickets that were right on the glass. And I don't know the name of the people next to me, but they were very enthusiastic fans. And they would be banging on the glass, shouting P-I-R-A-T-E-S. And like, really, it was like a brother, a mother, a grandkid, and everything else. Sad to say that I've left that location. Mm-hmm. I've renewed my Pirates tickets. But on the other side, there were some really nice club seats.
Right.
I'm right there.
You're right
there. So I'm back next year.
You're in the right place.
I am in the right place. Looking forward to Portland Pirates hockey. We've got Brian Petrovic here. Let's talk a little bit. I want to talk about Bruins and NHL and viewership and how hockey is where that really ranks in terms of other sports. But, you know, you live in Yarmouth. Yarmouth is a pretty good hockey town. Yarmouth High School is a good team, NYA. From your experience as a young kid learning how to play hockey, first of all, when did you first start playing, to what you see now, is hockey losing ground or picking up ground in terms of participation with young people, and how do you see that really affecting the sport going forward?
Yeah, I was fortunate to start the game probably 5 or 6 years old. I had two older brothers that played. So it was
outside of Boston?
Outside of Boston, Norwood, Massachusetts. So it was your typical, if you're the youngest of three boys, get in the net. We're going to shoot pucks at you.
Right.
And gave me an opportunity to start at a very early age. And for me, was fortunate to never leave that position, played goal my entire career. So when I look back and now look where the game is, and having had the opportunity to work for the national governing body at such a critical time when inline hockey was growing, women's hockey was just beginning, as we just talked about, the growth continues. It continues in the U.S., it continues in Canada, it continues in many countries in Europe. When you look at the eight countries that are really dominant ones in the sport, growth continues for on the men and women's side in terms of participation. So that's a good thing. And you would think that will translate to viewership growth and increases, and I think it has. However, we're still challenged in the U.S. with markets that have not attached themselves to the sport, even though the NHL has a national footprint. And so the growth is one that I think challenges many, but the sport has never been better. The quality of the athletes, the way athletes train, the way they perform on the ice, the economics of the business has improved. So I think on balance, I mean, I look at it as a growing business, and one that, like many, still has its challenges. But I think it's moving in the right direction, continues to. And you look at what the NHL continues to do with finding new ways to grow a fan base, to improve the fan experience, which, as you know, is so important. You look at the success of the outdoor games.
Right.
You know, a few years ago, there was just one of them. I think it might have started in Buffalo. And now, I think this year, there were six or seven of them. And so they've created a new platform, a new opportunity in a non-traditional way to find ways to introduce the sport, and in this particular case, through national television. And so I think they continue to grow. They can continue to find ways to expose the sport to more and more people, and I think that's encouraging, and I don't think that's anything that's going to change.
One of the games, I think it was at University of Michigan this year, I think either ESPN or one of the other, I don't know if it was HBO or ESPN, but they did a 4 or 5 part series, yep. Road to the Outdoor.
Right, exactly.
And they talked about the storyline. They talked about the mythology and not
behind
just
the scenes.
Behind the scenes, yeah. Which is...
It was incredibly attractive. And 100,000 people in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It was just amazing.
Yeah, and from a pure viewing standpoint, obviously in a stadium like that with 100,000, you're not seeing a lot of detail with the puck,
true.
But you're being there for the experience. And it was a snowy day, I think.
Right. And I think the thing about the game is, in as much as I think television has improved, production has improved, it's a game that you really can't experience to its fullest unless you're in the building.
Right.
And that's just the nature of the beast. Unlike football, unlike basketball, even baseball to a certain degree, that can be televised much easier, hockey is a difficult one to translate on TV, as you know.
I think I've told you my Bobby Orr story, but I'm going to tell it again because I never get tired of it. Shani, how many times have you heard me tell my Bobby Orr story?
I don't think I can count.
It's
Does it get better each time?
Absolutely.
I will embellish on this. I was on a plane going to Toronto maybe 3 or 4 years ago, flying out of Boston, and sitting in the Air Canada waiting area, and this guy sat down right next to me. His head was down. He was kind of being discreet in terms of just kind of sitting there quietly working on his laptop or something. He was like, we were elbow to elbow. And as I look over, because he was hitting my elbow a little bit. I'm like, what's going on? It's Bobby Orr.
No way.
Yeah. So I had known, I was involved in sports management decades ago, and Bob Wolf and one of his first agents and kind of a super agent in Boston that really did a lot for not only hockey, but in sports in general. So, and I was familiar that Bobby himself was part of a sports management group. I think it took over the Wolf practice
or
something.
Right. That's true.
And he was the guy who was going into families in America and mostly in Canada and saying, hey, I'm Bobby Orr. You should really work with our group.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're sitting there and I go, hey, Bobby, it's Steve Woods. And I was involved and I knew Bob Wolf. And he goes, oh, hey, how you doing? And we talked for about a half hour. And I told him I was one of the 2 million people that saw him score the Stanley Cup winning goal. And he goes, yeah, I hear that a lot. And he goes, yeah, you sound like you know the sport pretty well. Did you play? And I said, well, I grew up in Needham, which is a couple of towns over from Norwood. You know, we had Robbie Fatorik and Didigi, and we had some pretty good players.
That's right.
I wasn't one of them. But I learned to play on the Charles River. And he goes, well, were you any good? And as brilliant of a hockey player he is, and he's done a lot for the sport, I don't know exactly to what degree he's known for a sense of humor. Because I said, well, Bobby, I thought I was pretty good, but there was one area of my game where I really wasn't. And he was leaning forward like there was some sort of technical thing, and we were talking. And he goes, what was that? I go, I really couldn't skate backwards. And Bobby Orr, I thought, would laugh just like you did. See, that was the natural reaction. Yeah, that was the natural reaction.
Right, yeah.
And Bobby looked at me, and without a hint of humor or whimsy or anything, said, yeah, skating backwards is important. Coming from the best defenseman in history who is known. There are people right now. Shani, you're probably one of them. You've heard the name Bobby Orr, right?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Okay, have you ever seen any video or any television clips of Bobby Orr?
No.
Okay. See, young people today, even if you're not a hockey fan, anyone listening right now, well, this is airing on Saturday, so you're probably going to Home Depot to get some light bulbs. But when you get home, YouTube Best of Bobby Orr, and there's dozens of compilations of Bobby Orr stuff. There was something about the way that Bobby Orr would skate. The way he would go behind his, and this was before helmets too, so the game looks and feels different, right?
He was so graceful.
It's amazing. And then later on, he had knee problems, and he went to Chicago, and that cut his career short. But when you look at Bobby Orr, he would get the puck at his own blue line, back check, go behind his own net, and he would go coast to coast, and it would look like a man among boys.
Yeah.
And other guys would go, and he would go. You know, one season, I think he led the Bruins in scoring.
The league in scoring, too.
Well, the league in scoring as a defenseman.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Where he revolutionized the game. Yeah. It used to be defensemen would, you know, play defense and they'd bring it up and they'd be at the blue line and the other guys would score.
Yeah. No, but what a joy to watch.
Didn't he change the game from your perspective as a real hockey player?
I mean, it was all of a sudden defensemen could become part of the offense and could dominate offensively, whereas traditionally defensemen would be taking the puck and giving it up to forwards and let them do the work offensively. But he revolutionized the game. And, you know, when you look at the video, just deceptively fast and just had an amazing,
he looked like
amazing
gazelle.
Instincts. He did.
I can't even describe it, but his leg motion, the way he would glide, other guys would be like they were jogging in place.
And he's not very tall. I mean, it wasn't like he was 6'4", 6'5".
No, and he, what was the little town in Canada he was from, the famous?
Parry Sound.
Parry Sound,
Ontario.
Yeah, it's almost like Larry Bird from French Lick and Bobby Orr from Parry Sound.
Exactly.
And in both cases, they developed their early skills in these tiny towns.
Yeah. Skating on ponds.
Skating.
No question.
I skated on a river. A pond. We had ponds, but pond hockey was nothing.
You had those in Needham, too. Why didn't you just
find
them?
I know. There were a couple of ponds, but I look back now, and, you know, you know, my parents were like, sure, kids, go play hockey in the back. And I look back now, and it's like the river is, it's not raging. It's the Charles River.
Right.
But certainly I don't think that's recommended out there to let your kids play on a running river. By the way, we have Brian Petrovic with the Portland Pirates. He's been involved in running and leadership roles in the team for many, many years. Let's talk about, since we just talked about the Bruins, this will air on Saturday, and the Bruins are starting the playoffs. They've been, two out of the last 3 years, they've made it to the, was it not just the playoffs, but the finals?
Maybe the conference finals?
The finals, yeah. What do you see from your perspective in terms of how the Bruins look going into these Stanley Cup playoffs? And feels like they have many of the same guys there, and they have the best record in the NHL this year.
Yeah, they had an incredible regular season, but I think as the coach said in this morning's newspaper, it doesn't really matter how quickly that's forgotten. So it's the second season. As you know, as a fan of the sport, when you get into the Stanley Cup playoffs, you get the best 16 teams. Any one of them can win it, which is, I think, a credit to what the NHL has created in terms of parity. But they go in very strong. They get great goaltending. They're strong up the middle. And for those of us that look at the technical aspects of the sport, if you're strong up the middle, you got a good chance to win. And they've been consistent. They got great coaching. They've had consistency and continuity, which is important. Not a lot of changes in personnel. They're a very stable organization. They can muck it up when they need to, but they can, you know, run up the score as well. So the interesting thing will be the matchup. They play a team with a lot of pride. It's going to be great for two of the original six teams to go at each other in the first round of the playoff, and one of those teams is not going to make it any further, which is the beauty of the Stanley Cup. So they go in with a lot of pressure, and there's no question about it, but it looks like they have the chemistry and the character to take it all the way.
What about Char? Is he like, you know, 7'9" or something? Obviously, I'm exaggerating. But
he's the real deal. I mean,
what a freak of, not in a positive way. I was going to say a freak of nature.
Yeah.
But to see a hockey player that tall, that big, that physical, and yet that nimble, skilled.
No, it's amazing what he could do for his size in so many different aspects. And he's a leader, which really pulls it all together. I wasn't a big Chara fan when he first came to Boston, but now I've had an opportunity to see him so much on TV.
How tall is he?
He's 6'6", maybe? I don't know. He's tall.
Every once in a while, some 5'9" guy will want to drop gloves against him, and he almost just says, hey, little man.
Yeah, don't waste my time.
Do not waste my time, because they're always trying to take him out of the game.
Right.
And so they're always going at him, wanting to get matching penalties, that type of thing.
But he's got a maturity and a poise to him that just is second to none, and that's just has rubbed off on the rest of his team in terms of the confidence they have in him as a leader. And the amount of ice he logs is incredible as well. And he doesn't get hurt, which is another, you know, thing that you want to have with your captain. And
he's the Mack truck, and all the Hyundais are bouncing off him.
Big time. So it's going to be exciting to watch. But, you know, you look at all these matchups, and it's too bad these 16 teams can't just play each other more often, because it's they're truly the best. And the game just rises to another level when you get into the playoffs anyway. The speed, you know, the 82-game schedule for regular season, it's a grind, and now they start fresh.
Yeah, I actually wish that, and I'm a big supporter of NBA and NHL, but to your point, it and I understand why, but as a fan, I wish that in both sports, maybe all sports, maybe it's just the nature of sport, whether it's baseball, if the energy and the passion you see in the playoffs, if there was a way to have that from the beginning of the season.
You're right.
And it's human nature. You know, if you ask the players and the coaches, are you trying your best in November and December?
Yeah.
They're going to say we're trying our best.
Right.
But obviously there's another gear. They shift into fifth or sixth gear because the pay, everything's a little faster.
Oh, yeah.
Everything's a little harder.
A little bit more intense.
And more intense. Yeah. And there's just...
Yeah. You can feel it. And the fans feel it too.
Yeah.
So it is tough. I mean, even in our league, we play too many games. You know, the performance schedule just can drain on you, and it drains on your fans. You have too much inventory, and so it invariably over the course of a 28-week schedule, there are highs and lows, and there are times when you're not giving it your all, and it's just the way, unfortunately, the way the business runs. But the playoffs is a whole new game.
By the way, we have Brian Petrovic. He's with the Portland Pirates, and anyone interested in looking at Portland Pirates tickets for next year when they return to Portland and the Civic Center, their website's www.portlandpirates.com. Back onto the Bruins just for a quick sec, their goalkeeping. What happened a couple of years ago when what's his name said, "No mas, I don't want to play anymore"? Was it Thomas?
Tim Thomas, yeah.
So Tim Thomas, yeah. First of all, you were, most valuable player, goalkeeper of Beanpot. You were All-American honors as a goaltender at Harvard, and you were drafted by both the LA Kings and Edmonton Oilers. So you are a goalkeeper. So this, what I'm about to say, does not apply to you, Brian. But most people look at goalkeepers as being, I don't want to say a little nuts, but it's almost like from the movie Slapshot, which we'll talk about. There's such kind of frenetic tension. You picture goalkeepers in their natural persona as the people who have had 50 cups of coffee, because from the moment they were 5 years old, people have been shooting pucks at their head at 100 miles an hour. So they go through their life being a little on edge. And Thomas, famously a few years ago with the Bruins, whether it was a contract dispute or he was burnt out, said, "I'm just staying yeah. home." And didn't he have a year left in his contract or something?
And at the top of his game. Yeah. So some have said what you just referred to. There, it's a different breed.
Yeah,
and with the position comes as a certain type of individual and a certain character that has to go with it. But when you look back when he did it. The Bruins knew they had somebody in Providence, Rhode Island, playing on the American Hockey League team in Tuukka Rask that was ready to go and could take his place in a heartbeat. And look at what he's done since Tim left. So
it was almost seamless, right? I mean, his numbers are about the same. Won the Stanley Cup.
Yeah. And Tuukka's, he's just beginning to get good. I mean, you talk about a kid that's got confidence, but he paid his dues at the American League level, was ready to come in when Thomas decided to move in a different direction. So for the Bruins, it probably was a great outcome. And maybe just
Didn't Thomas come back this year?
Who did he? I think he was with Florida maybe for a little bit this year, if I remember correctly, and has had his ups and downs. Maybe the year off was not the best thing for him to do at his age. I don't think his comeback was perhaps the way he envisioned it in terms of his readiness to play, but he's giving it a go, but it's taking its toll on him. But he's a different animal.
How are goaltenders, in all of your experience in terms of running the Portland Pirates, playing yourself, and being part of USA? Are goalkeepers a different breed? So you have the rest of the team who are position players, and the bottom line is if you're there's five position players on the ice during a shift, and the center, the forwards, the two different. Those guys are all almost interchangeable. They play different positions. Some are faster, but they're all basically skating around. And then you have this one guy in pads who's sitting there with a mask. Back when Jerry Cheevers was playing for the Bruins, there were no masks, or just before that, which seems insane.
It is insane.
And then they had masks with like these little magic marker things, and then obviously now they've got better technology. But what is the psychology that goes into being an effective goalkeeper? Because part of it's reflex, which has to be key. Part of it is hand-eye coordination. But part of it has to be something deep in the psyche of somebody to go, yeah, I'm fine sitting here having people shoot pucks at me from every angle. And what is a goalkeeper the makeup of that?
Well, it's the best position in the sport.
by a goalkeeper.
Well, there's no other position where you can play in the entire 60 minutes.
Right.
Everybody else has to take a breath and sit on the bench for a little bit. Goalkeepers don't have to do that. They're the quarterback of the team. I've always felt that. The goalie that's really successful is the leader on the ice. He's constantly communicating with his players. He can see the game from a different perspective. The game's coming at him, and then the game's going away from him. So when I was playing, I always took that approach that I'm in a unique position to run the team on the ice, to be vocal, to control the puck. It's not just having the puck come at you and have it hit you and God knows what's going to happen afterwards. To be able to control the play, to be able to manage rebounds, to be able to then take the puck and move it in a direction that allows your team to move up ice and to communicate is what makes it a rare position. So there's no better position in sport. And when you look at it as one that is the only one that can play the entire time, you never have to leave the ice. So why would anybody want to play any other position that can only play a third of the time? Doesn't make any sense.
Absolutely. Spoken like a goalie. But it's also a position that has the unique burden of either getting too much credit for wins or too much blame for losses.
And that's the beauty of it as well.
What does that do to the psyche? Because if you are the goalie and it's a close game and you know, something dribbles by or you didn't clear, you know, the rebound. The other players on the ice, there's plus minus stats, but for the most part, the other five guys are working, and there's shift changes and everything. Right. So it's really hard to point a finger at one of the other people on who won or lost.
That's right.
But in a loss, if the goalkeeper was just off and he let in some soft goals, then there's nowhere to hide.
Right.
It's the goalkeeper lost tonight.
But that's the accountability that comes with the position that makes it such a special one to play. You know, you are totally responsible. You are taking the good and the bad, and from a management perspective, it creates a new level of accountability. And I always liked that, and I think it always motivated me to be better because of the responsibility that the position has, unlike the other positions on the ice.
Were you a Ken Dryden fan?
I love Ken Dryden.
So, as a young kid growing up, who were your heroes in the sport?
Bernie Parent was really the guy that I tried to play like. I just liked the way he played on his feet, liked the way he cut his angles, just liked his competitiveness. And in Philadelphia at the time was a very popular team to watch. But I took different aspects of different goalies as I was growing up and tried to marry that into a style of my own. But Dryden, I had the opportunity to watch when he was at Cornell. And I was close at the time growing up in Norwood with Jack Kelly, who was the coach at Boston University at the time, who went on to run the New England Whalers. And I played youth hockey with Jack's kids. So I always had the opportunity to go to BU hockey games. It was my introduction to the Beanpot, among other things. But the BU-Cornell games when Dryden was playing was just incredible. But Dryden was unique. Because he was so big. I mean, he was really the first goalie of his size to be a dominant player. But it just made me more and more intrigued about the role that a goalie can play with the success of a hockey team, and what he did during his days at Cornell, and then as he went on to Montreal was just incredible. But a student of the game, which was what I tried to be as well, to learn the game and to be that coach on the ice, I thought was also a very important part of being a successful goaltender. Not just stop the puck, but to actually run the team while the play was going on.
And talk about that a little bit from your experience both with the Pirates and playing yourself. What do you look for in a young goalie other than, you know, the reflex and the hand-eye coordination? Because there is, as you said, a lot of leadership. There is there's a level of intelligence that's needed because you really have to be thinking about the game. Yep. And it's not just purely a physical game. There's a lot of strategy, a lot of angles.
Yeah, yeah.
You know that if the puck is over there and the defense is shifting.
You're absolutely right.
If you're not thoughtful about it, you could be the most gifted athlete in the world, and the puck's going to get in the net.
And for me, that's where I think it was a big part of my success. I was always trying to learn about the game, not just learn how to play the position. And I would spend a lot of time with our coach. I would actually go with our coaching staff when I was at Harvard to games that were in different parts of Boston, teams that we were going to play in the next week or so, to pre-scout them so I could understand how they approached offensive play, how they set up for a power play, so that I could expect and I could forecast some things that would happen because of a knowledge of the game and not just how fast is the puck going to fly at me. That's the easy part. If you get your positional play down and you know how to control the puck, that's one aspect of it. But the more you can learn about what the other team is going to do, but at the same time also be knowledgeable about what your team is doing when it has possession of the puck and what happens if it makes a mistake, what do you have to be ready for? And it's always, to me, it was always helpful to be one step ahead of everybody else and be more knowledgeable. And that, I think, made me a better player.
We've got Brian Petrovic here. And this is kind of a whimsical question, but who, in from your perspective, and we'll go with non-goalie because obviously that was your position, so you're obvious. But in the non-goalie category, who would you say are the three best players that you've ever watched in the NHL? It's one of those debates that every sport has: who's better than who. But three players that if you were putting together a team, or if you were going to put your Hall of Fame three, what players would you say? I know it's hard.
That's a good one.
I mean, there's the Gretzky and modern day. Do you think Crosby makes it because he's a special kid?
Yeah, he'd have to be.
Bobby Orr.
Guys like a Steve Yzerman. You know, guys that were leaders at a very young age.
He played in Detroit. It doesn't feel like he ever got the same credit and acclaim as a Gretzky,
and he should
have, or an Orr, or some of the other players.
Yeah, but his, I think his discipline, his focus, his competitiveness, and now look at his success as a general manager in Tampa.
Right,
it's just carried on. So, I mean, he'd be one. Of course, the Gretzkys, and you know, I'm trying to think right now because as a former goalie, I'm always focused on quality defensemen, but. You know, you look at guys like a Larry Robinson, you know, guys, you know, go way back, kind of an old school player, moved on to become a very successful coach. But guys that were just disciplined, were focused, talented, but also great team players. And a lot of those players coming out of the Montreal Canadiens over the years as I was growing up were always just impressive teammates and impressive team players. So I think Robinson comes to mind on defense. You know, you look at a Ray Bourque. Look at what he was able to do over the course of his career.
Number 77,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are others. You threw a curve at me there, Steve, so I gotta think that one through. But there's so many, and then you know, and on the goaltending side, you know, guys like Perron. I mean, you know, Patrick Roy when he played in Montreal. I mean, his competitiveness, and now to see what he's been able to do with the Colorado Avalanche just in a single season. To change that entire dynamic in that franchise and bring it back to competitive, hard-nosed, winning hockey, and a coach can do that. And he was like that as a player.
I talked to somebody a year ago, and they made I thought it was kind of a silly suggestion, but he said, you know, if I owned a hockey team, I would find the fattest guy I could find. And I don't know if he was looking at me. He may have been a dig. And he goes, if you could just put a very large person in goal. They wouldn't have the reflexes, obviously, but they would take up a lot of space with the pads and everything.
There's a reason why that's never happened, though.
And the reason is the game's too fast.
The game's too fast. It wouldn't work. And the players are too smart. They could find a way to get around and in between that oversized person. But the goaltender, and I've always believed this, has to be the best skater on the ice. His movement is critical. And you can't just be big and cover the net. There's more to it than that.
Yeah, I agree. I think decades ago the skating part wasn't as emphasized, but you watch goaltenders now and
they have to.
They're
move.
Very fluid. And very
athletic.
Being that quick in your skates in a small space isn't easy. It's not like you just slide over. You have to really have.
Yeah, particularly with the speed of the game right now, and it's much faster than it was when I played. That's for sure.
Another element of the sport that I'm interested in kind of getting your thoughts on is fighting. Rarely do goaltenders, you know, you see it every once in a while and it makes the highlights. You know, there's a big brawl. Goaltenders look at each other for about 3 minutes and then after a while they go, okay, let's get into it. But how, both in the NHL and all the affiliate leagues, first of all, why is it such an important or significant element in the sport? There have been talk over years where if the sport wanted to eliminate fighting or greatly reduce it, it wouldn't be that hard. It would just be a policy shift. If all of a sudden it went from a 2-minute penalty or a 5-minute fighting penalty, but if you were ejected for 2 games, if the sport wanted to, I don't know if you could ever totally eliminate fighting because something would always happen, but if they wanted to greatly reduce it, the sport could say, here's the new penalty, and it. Do you think it's good for the sport, bad for the sport? Is it what fans expect? Is it a primal thing where people go to a hockey game, they want to see fighting, and do you think it'll ever change?
Well, I'm not an advocate. I'm not, in this personal opinion. And you look at the Olympic Games where it's not allowed. So you could turn the switch on and off and eliminate it. And I don't think negatively affect the quality of the performance. Others would argue it's a natural outcome of the physicality of the sport. It's the way the physical nature plays itself out, and then it's penalized. So those who are in favor of keeping it will say, well, we have control over it. We have ways of managing it through the penalty box or through suspensions. So that's one argument. And many at the higher level will continue to say, if we eliminated it, we'd lose share of the market. We'd lose fans who are fans of the sport because of the fighting. And others will claim just the opposite, that the sport could grow exponentially if it didn't have fighting because it would attract a constituency or two that otherwise is not favorably disposed to the sport because of fighting. So I don't think personally the sport would suffer if it eliminated it. but it's not going to happen in my lifetime. I just don't see it happening, but it could. And I think the Olympics is a good indicator, right, and a good example of an environment where you get the best players in the world who are very physical, very disciplined, very emotional, very intense.
Maybe they're the same players.
Yeah. And they're the same players.
So the same NHL players, right, that you see at, you know, right, the Bruins, and many of them are playing in the same Olympics.
But in the Olympics, it's not allowed. And, yeah, and it's not penalized.
And nobody at the end of the game goes, man, that was a great game. Too bad there wasn't more fighting. I agree with you, and I would take it a step further where in every sport, as training gets better, as health and nutrition gets better, the athletes are getting stronger and quicker. And although there is a mechanism to kind of penalize fighting, being, you know, the penalty box or suspension, I don't know how you penalize somebody if somebody gets a detached retina. I don't know how you penalize somebody if there's a higher incident of concussions.
No question.
Or somebody falls on the ice and their head hits the ice. Yep. And some of those consequences can either be career-ending or life or death. Yep. And I do wish the sport took a closer look at it because, you know, in our society, both in every sport, people are much more aware of concussions, both mm-hmm. on youth level, mm-hmm. which is more awareness. My right. daughter, who plays basketball, has had a couple of concussions in the last couple of years, and there's so many more and better protocols.
True.
And so there's new science about head injuries.
Right.
And so historically, you know, somebody, you know, in football, Tom Brady gets knocked to the ground and his head hits the AstroTurf and everybody's like, oh, Tom Brady, this could be a concussion.
Right.
Yet we have boxing, you know, right. same thing, professional versus yeah. amateur, where in a boxing match, many boxers will suffer 40 concussions in one match.
Right.
But nobody has the same feeling.
True.
And then you watch a hockey game where two guys grab their shirts and they're so athletic that they're almost like punching robots.
Right.
One guy gets in 5 punches to the head, the other guy gets in 4, and, you know, there could be head injuries.
No question. I think we're seeing the data now more than ever because we've just become more sophisticated about the problems associated with head injuries.
Right.
And, you know, years ago when I was playing, I'm sure we had teammates who were getting concussions all the time.
I was knocked out once playing basketball. I went to the hospital the next day. The coach was like, you got to play.
Yeah, and I'm sure I had a few, but were never diagnosed. But now with technology, with just more scrutiny, with just more focus on athletes and what's happening to them, it's becoming more and more of an issue. I think at the end of the day, the only way it will change is if the players, because at the end of the day, they are
the player assets. Sport, right,
it's
right.
The player sports. If they take a step back and they decide, because if they decide to eliminate fighting will be eliminated.
It would also, I think, change the sport. Like, you know, back 40 years ago, they'd call them goons, right?
Yeah.
Every team would have 2 or 3 guys that were basically just built to fight.
Right.
And so something happened or somebody, you know, was aggressive with your star player, you'd send out Bruno, who would go out there and just knock some other guy's head out.
Right, right.
If you eliminated the fighting through policy, there would be more skill positions.
True.
And, you know.
True. And most teams now don't have room for the quote-unquote goons. They may have physical players who are there to protect other players, but they have to be skilled. And so that has changed. And, you know, in our business and in our sport, You've been seeing a decline in fighting. You know, I think last year we may have bumped up a little bit in the other direction, but over the last 5 or 6 years, the American Hockey League has seen a decline in fighting. So I think you're seeing the players that are coming up through the ranks fighting less, taking a different approach to protecting themselves, and maybe at the end of the day, they will be the ones to take control of the argument.
I hope. Yeah, you're listening to News Talk, WLOB, 1310 AM, Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. As we finish up here, Brian, let's... We started with the intro music to the movie Slapshot. I love sports movies because not only as I've been involved with sports, they're entertaining, but I think there's also life lessons. Your favorite hockey movies? We've got Slapshot, Miracle, Mystery Alaska, Mighty Ducks. You know, as if somebody who's been involved with hockey for decades. Do you have, like, a special collection at home?
Well, my good friend David Kelly was Mystery Alaska, so I got to be careful about that one.
Okay.
But, no, I, I would have to say the Lake Placid story would have to be it. I mean, I was fortunate to play against a lot of those guys that were on that team, and knew them very well, have maintained relationships with many of them since that day. So to see that story come about, to actually have the opportunity to be there when I was working for the ECAC, to see what took place in that village was just incredible. And I think the movie did a great job.
Had you met Coach Brooks?
Oh, yeah.
Herb Brooks?
Knew him very well. And ironically, when I was with the New Jersey Devils, Herb was one of our coaches for some of the time that I was there. So knew him very well and incredibly successful, as you know. And
right.
and you talk about a motivated, competitive individual, and that's the reason for his success.
Yeah, I don't know if people realize it, but not only in terms of his career, but did he die in a car accident a few years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
But
tragic.
That movie, Miracle, was it Miracle on Ice was the official title? Well, the scene early in the movie where the setup in the movie was as part of USA Hockey, he was selected as a coach. The governing body had a bunch of players. The advisor group all had their thoughts. He picked a group of people, a group of guys, and said, "These are my guys."
He knew.
He knew because he knew that it wasn't just about physical traits, but it was the chemistry.
Yep.
But there was a scene in the movie, and I think it was after an early game, where he had them late at night.
The wind sprints.
The wind sprints.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And one of the most, if you haven't seen the movie, Miracle on Ice, whether you like hockey, don't like hockey, or you even care about hockey, one of the best movies I've ever seen. And when he's having them do sprints and he's asking them, who do you play for?
Exactly.
Most of the players all came from college. So it'd be, right. I play for BU.
Right.
I play for Minnesota. Or yeah. I play for, and then they do more sprints. And then they were falling over. And one guy was throwing up. And then the lights came out. And it was building to this crescendo of emotion and patriotism. And the other coaches were like, Herb, you're killing the guys. You've got to get the. And he's like, no. Right. Who do you play for? And another kid would yell, you know, Toronto or something. And then finally, and I forget who the player was.
It was Arizioni.
Arizioni. Mike Arizioni, right?
Right.
Goalie.
No, forward.
He was the captain.
Yep. Yeah.
And so the question that Herb asked, who do you play for? And he was like, USA, right?
Yeah, that was it. Defining moment.
That was the end, because they were all oriented to what team they played for.
Right.
And until they kind of subordinated and submitted themselves to the greater good of the team.
Yep. And that was the turning point. And that was Herb. And he was all about that. And he I'm sure, orchestrated that thing and knew it was going to take place when it took place. And he knew how many more days or weeks
they had.
And that's the way he built teams.
And who's the goalie again from that team?
Jimmy Craig, who I played against when I was at Harvard. He was at BU. We had great rivalry, the two of us.
I was lucky enough to meet him back in the 80s. He was involved, you know, and he's still as an ambassador.
Yep.
He's still involved in camps and everything else.
Yep.
And well,
he's a good man.
We're going to have you come back sometime. We're running out of time, Brian.
Thanks, Steve. Love to.
Well, this
was great. It was fun.
Yeah. Well, next time, I want to talk to you about sports here in Maine, sports economy in Maine, and talk about what's going on for our future in terms of all the great things happening, and we'll talk about sports commission stuff. Love to talk to you about that.
Love to. It's great. Thank you.
Great. Well, we've had Brian Petrovic here. If you're interested in getting your tickets for next year for the Portland Pirates moving back into the Civic Center, go to their website, portlandpirates.com. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM.